Thursday was a day of quiet ceremony in the U.S. Senate chamber as Congress opened the third ever impeachment trial of a president. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye.
The Senate sergeant at arms began the proceedings, and House prosecutors formally presented the impeachment articles.
Article 1, abuse of power.
Another on obstructing Congress.
The escort committee will now conduct the Chief Justice of the United States to the dais.
When the Chief Justice walked in, you could feel the weight of the moment.
All 100 senators will be jurors.
Do you solemnly swear?
And John Roberts had them recite an oath to do impartial justice. Democrats like Mazie Hirono say they want to hear the president defend himself.
We've heard nothing except him calling it a witch hunt.
Not long after, he used another favored phrase in rejecting the impeachment bid.
A phony hoax.
Sagar Magani at the White House.
President Trump is disparaging claims by Lib Parnas, a former associate of his personal attorney, that he was fully aware of pressure applied on Ukraine to launch an investigation of a political rival and thus potentially benefit Mr. Trump's re-election chances.
The accusations are being made by Lev Parnas, who is under indictment for funneling foreign contributions to U.S. political candidates, including Trump. The president calls them the current hoax.
He's trying to probably make a deal for himself.
Trump says he does not recall any conversation with Parnas, who is also implicating Vice President Mike Pence and Attorney General William Barr as being part of the plan to get Ukraine to announce an investigation into former Vice President Joe Biden. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
A former Canadian Armed Forces reservist and two other men who authorities say are linked to a violent white supremacist group were arrested Thursday, just days before they were believed to be headed to a pro-gun rally in the state of Virginia's capital. This is VOA News. The U.S. Senate has passed the new long-delayed North American Free Trade Agreement, AP's Ed Donahue.
The U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement cruised through the Senate.
The yeas are 89. The nays are 10.
Improving the North American Free Trade Agreement was a key part of President Trump's campaign in 2016. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says people in Mexico and Canada buy $500 billion worth of American goods and services every year.
That includes more than a quarter of all the food and agricultural products grown here in the United States.
President Trump complained NAFTA encouraged companies to move their manufacturing plants south of the border. He is expected to sign the USMCA bill next week. Ed Donahue, Washington.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security is reportedly asking the Pentagon to pay for nearly 483 kilometers of border wall as part of a drug-fighting effort. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
Insiders say the Pentagon is reviewing a request that it pay for 270 miles of border wall, along with lighting and roads, from counter-narcotics funding. Most Democrats in Congress oppose the use of military funding for wall construction. They say the president is planning to steal $7.2 billion in counter-narcotics and military construction funding to pay for the wall that Mexico was supposed to pay for. The Supreme Court this summer allowed the president to use military funding. It's estimated $12 billion has gone for wall construction, and billions more have been requested. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Russia's ruling party on Thursday unanimously backed President Vladimir Putin's a surprise choice for prime minister for a man with almost no political profile. Reuters' Lauren Anthony has details.
Former Premier Dmitry Medvedev and his cabinet stepped down on Wednesday, making way for Mikhail Mishustin, the 53-year-old head of the tax service. He has little public profile except having been known to play ice hockey with Putin and had not been spoken of as a potential candidate. These factors are seemingly part of Putin's strategy to open up opportunity to diminish the powers of the presidency and beef up those of the prime minister. Analysts have called Mishustin a technocratic placeholder. He will inevitably be viewed as a possible successor to a shrunken presidency, as will members of his cabinet, many of whom are expected to be new to government.
That is Reuters' Lauren Anthony reporting. You can find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, January 17th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. The World Food Program says 45 million people in the Southern African region are gravely food insecure.
The whole of Southern Africa is in the throes of a climate emergency. And the World Food Program's estimates that there are an amazing 45 million people who are facing hunger.
There are reports that Lesotho's prime minister may resign next week. Kenya commemorates the anniversary of Al-Shabaab terrorist attack on the International Hotel. Liberia's vice president stays away from work after complaining about the lack of proper security. And Uganda's government says it will provide mandatory security for Bobi Wine.
If government is saying they want to provide security for Honorable Chagulanyi, let them do it in an organized manner. Write to us, notify us, or call us, and let's have a discussion.
Joe Senyonyi is the spokesperson for Bobi Wine's People Power Movement, and Zimbabwe's government proposes a constitutional amendment. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's posts, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The World Food Program, WFP, says 45 million people, mostly women and children in the Southern African region, are gravely food insecure due to repeated drought, widespread flooding, and economic disarray. The agency is appealing to the international community to save lives by providing the necessary funding of about $489 million. Jean Howard, senior spokesperson for the WFP, says the food crisis in the hardest hit countries like Zimbabwe, Zambia, Mozambique, Madagascar, Namibia, Lesotho, Eswatini, and Malawi is on a level never seen before.
We're really, really worried. I mean, we're saying that the whole of Southern Africa is in the throes of a climate emergency. And the World Food Program's estimates that there are an amazing 45 million people who are facing hunger. And that means they're not just struggling to get enough food on a day-to-day basis, but they're already skipping meals, selling off their livestock, selling off everything just to buy food. And although we're helping a lot of people, the needs are really very, very great. And we're worried that the weather forecast is not good and another cyclone season could make things even worse.
What are you doing right now to help this situation?
Well, we are planning to provide more than 8 million people with food in 8 different countries. We give people basic food rations just to keep them going. In countries where there is food in the shops, then we give cash or vouchers to go out and choose their own food. And we're doing long-term projects. So we're involved in trying to help smallholder farmers just kind of cushion themselves against the shocks, sometimes selling or helping them with insurance schemes that pay out if the forecast for the weather is really bad. However, we're not doing enough because the scale is so big. We're trying to scale up, but we need a lot more money. And we've only really got about half of the money that we need even for the next 6 months.
You say you need a lot more money. What's your goal for the funding?
Well, to provide funding for the 8 countries in the region until June, just to help the most vulnerable, we're not talking about feeding everybody, we would need $489 million. And we've received nearly half of that from countries and from private individuals and from companies, but we're still very much falling short. So that may mean that we won't be able to reach everybody who needs this food.
We hear a lot about drought and hunger situation, food insecurity in countries like Zimbabwe, Zambia. What are the countries that are the hardest hit?
You're absolutely right that Zimbabwe is definitely the hardest hit. It's got the highest number of people that we're planning to assist, that we're really hoping to assist over 4 million people there, partly because they've had 5 years without normal rain conditions. In Zimbabwe, like in many countries in the region, there's not much irrigation, there's not much in the reservoirs. They rely simply on rain-fed agriculture. That means if it rains, you're fine. If it doesn't, you have no way of kind of conserving the water. The real reason that Zimbabwe is particularly badly hit, though, this time, is that the economy is in a bad way. Inflation is really, really, you know, at record levels. And in the past, although people have had jobs, now they're relying on remittances from relatives.
Jean, we thank you very much again for taking this time to speak with us. Do appreciate very much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Jane.
Jean Howard is a senior spokesperson for the World Food Programme. She was speaking with us from Rome, Italy. The president of the Law Society of Lesotho says the group's council plans to meet today, Friday, to discuss alleged plans by Prime Minister Thomas Tabani to resign next week. Monsignani Masipoli says the police are currently investigating the murder of the Prime Minister's estranged wife, which many say is creating tension in the country. Opposition and civil society groups, as well as the ruling All Basotho Convention Party, ABC, said the Prime Minister's resignation would enable the police to conduct an independent investigation into the assassination of his first wife, Lepole Tabani, in 2017. Lesotho Law Society President Masipoli tells viewers Peter Clotty that it would be an unusual judicial practice for a political office holder to step down before the individual is found guilty by a court in the kingdom.
There are so many issues that are linked to this thing of the political parties calling upon the current prime minister to resign. Because amongst them, we have this issue of the first lady. As we speak, the police have been looking for him. The warrant of apprehension has been issued against her to have her arrested in relation to the murder of the second wife of the Prime Minister, Ms. Dr. Thomas Motsoaledi Tabani, Ms. Dipolelo Tabani. And as we speak, she's not in the country. She's nowhere to be seen, or nowhere to be found. And it is alleged that the Prime Minister and the current First Lady are involved in the murder of the second wife of the Prime Minister, Ms. Dipolelo Tabani.
What is your take when some people are calling neighboring South Africa and the international community to help Lesotho to ease political tension in the country?
For now, I think the matter hasn't got out of hand as far as Lesotho is concerned. I think Lesotho is still within its powers to solve its own problems because basically some of the problems are domestic problems. For instance, if someone is alleged to have committed an offense, like the first lady is alleged to have committed an offense of murder of the second wife of the Prime Minister, Ms. Dipolelo Tabani, it is the matter that falls within the purview, within the jurisdiction of the Court of Lesotho or the law enforcement agencies.
As an advocate, if a political figure is alleged to have committed a crime, is it practical to have that person or that figure or that individual step aside to pave way for a thorough independent investigation without any bias? Is that a practice in the mountainous kingdom of Lesotho?
The judicial regular process in that respect is that if a minister, like you have just mentioned, Peter, is charged with a criminal offense, he cannot be called upon to step aside from his ministerial post because, in my view, that would be in stark violation with the provisions of the 1993 Lesotho Constitution. It talks about the right to a fair trial. And the right to a fair trial, amongst others, encompasses a suspect or an accused person before a criminal court. And the section says if a person has been charged with a criminal offense, he shall be presumed to be innocent until he has pleaded guilty and or has been found guilty by a court of competent jurisdiction.
Monsignani Masipoli is the president of the Lesotho Law Society. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Maseru. The Ugandan government says it will provide mandatory security for opposition politician Robert Chakulayi, also known as Bobi Wine. Obiega Mario Kanya, Uganda's Minister of Interior, says Bobi Wine is an influential individual who the government must provide security for at all costs. But Joe Senyonyi, the spokesperson for Chakulayi's People Power Movement, says the move is creating fear among Bobi Wine supporters.
Obiega Mario Kanya, Uganda Internal Affairs Minister, told the parliament this Wednesday that the government will keep providing Chagurani with security before and during election period.
I can tell you it is the duty of the security right now to see where Bobi Wine is for his own safety. Whether they do it covered, under whatever, they must do it. They must. Because Bobi Wine is an asset in this country.
Joel Senyonyi is the spokesperson for People Power Movement, a political pressure group headed by Chagurani. Senyonyi says members of People Power Movement are living in fear because they are usually confronted by unidentified plainclothes people.
Well, every once in a while you see somebody you don't know, and then the assumption is maybe that person is a supporter. But if it's a supporter, they just wave and, you know, keep at bay. But if somebody keeps very close, they're getting close to the car, they want to remain around the car, you become suspicious. And so the instinctive thing to do is to send them off because we don't know who they are, we don't know what their intentions are.
Charles Romushana, a security and political expert, describes this kind of arrangement as an open arrest. Romushana says by deploying security personnel to Chagruanyi, the state is curtailing its rights movement and association.
The moment you are under security, then it means you will be restricted. Restricted in terms of where you go, and at the same time restricted by those people who come to you will certainly have some bit of restriction. Now, if you refuse that security then, and you are eliminated, of course, then they will have an excuse to say they gave you security and you refuse it.
Senyonyi says his leader is willing to accept security personnel with clear descriptions of their roles.
If government is saying they want to provide security for Honorable Chagulanyi, let them do it in an organized manner. Write to us, notify us, or call us, and let's have a discussion and say, you want to provide us with security, and let's agree on a couple of things.
Uganda laws require presidential aspirants to be provided with bodyguards and escorts after they have been officially nominated. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, January 17th. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. On January 15, 2019, when Al-Shabaab terrorists attacked an international hotel and office complex in Nairobi, hotel nurse Noel Kadilaza was shot five times. She survived the attack, only to die earlier this month, January 2nd, as a result of her injuries just ahead of the one-year anniversary. As Kadaliza's surviving relatives Thursday held a memorial service for the latest casualty of the attack, her surviving husband called on Kenyan authorities to do more to stop the Islamist militant group. Rael Ombuo reports from Nairobi.
52-year-old Noel Kadaliza was a hotel nurse at the Dusit D2 Hotel in Nairobi on January 15, 2019, when Al-Shabaab militants attacked. Kadaliza's husband, Bernard Kisanya, says the attack changed his family's life forever.
She was the hotel nurse at Dusit. She was employed as a hotel nurse, the only nurse in that hotel. During that incident, she had gone out. When she came back, she ran when she had the explosion. But she realized that there was a patient, so she went back. When she went back, that's the time she met those terrorists.
The Islamist militants shot Kadaliza five times, two in the shoulder and three in the stomach. Kisanya says emergency medical workers got his wife to the Avenue Hospital about an hour after she was shot. Dr. Paul Odula was the operating surgeon.
She looked very down and hopeless. Like she had multiple bullet wounds on her and in her tummy, and she was just lying there. That's the first thing I saw, and she was just lying on a stretcher. Yeah, so I came in, took her to theater, and yeah, realized that it was a mess in the tummy. Yeah, it was like spaghetti in the tummy instead of intestines. It was a mess. So surgery took us quite a bit of time, I think like five hours about, to clean her up and connect everything back together.
Despite her severe injuries, Kadaliza survived and a few weeks later was discharged from the hospital. But even when she seemed to be getting better, there were complications. Because of Kidaliza's multiple wounds, says Dr. Odula, she had to constantly fight off infections.
Well, she was a fighter. Once she realized she was alive, she fought. She struggled. She tried to keep going. She was very lively, outgoing. But I got to learn later. You know, I hadn't knew her before, but afterwards, she's a colleague, I mean, a nurse. But we talked and she talked and she kept fighting, yes. Trying. And whenever she had an issue, she'd come back.
But after months of struggle, her liver failed and she died on January 2nd, just 2 weeks ahead of the one-year anniversary of the attack. The family of Noel Kadaliza Thursday held a private memorial service. Friends and relatives described Kadaliza as hardworking, warm, kind, and generous. Her surviving husband, Kisanya, says she was a loving, nurturing mother to their children.
My wife was a woman of substance. She loved her family. She was a woman. She gave her life to her family.
Kenyan authorities have vowed to stop the militant group, which is an affiliate of Al-Qaeda. The Islamists have been fighting the government in Mogadishu ever since. Kenya sent troops to Somalia in 2011 to fight Al-Shabaab alongside the African Union mission in Somalia with forces from at least six African countries. Al-Shabaab has demanded all foreign troops leave Somalia and gives Kenya's military presence in the country as reasons for its attacks. Raya Lombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Liberian Vice President Juwa Taylor has asked the Senate to intervene on her behalf to get the necessary budgetary support for her office. Vice President Taylor, who boycotted the official opening of the legislature on Monday, said in her letter to the Senate that the government also failed to provide her with two armored vehicles for her protection. Moses Garcia will report from Monrovia.
Vice President Joel Howard Taylor's communication to the Senate pro tempore took Liberians by surprise. The vice president was blunt. She described the difficulties she was encountering in running the second highest office in the country. Vice President Taylor said her security is not guaranteed as two bulletproof vehicles intended for her motorcade have not been made available, something she says put her at a huge security risk. She also said she was encountering financial difficulties in running her office due to the failure of the relevant institution to provide the necessary funding. Richmond Newville is Vice President Taylor's press secretary.
I cannot confirm or deny the authentic nature of the letter. I do know that the letter was sent to the pro tem office. That letter, we cannot speak to it until we can see its original content.
The pro tempore of the Liberian Senate, Abuchi, also confirmed Vice President Taylor's letter to the Senate and her concerns about the lack of funding for her office.
The Senate received a letter from the Vice President last weekend to the effect that she asked for intervention in a situation involving her office and the Ministry of Finance that has to do with delay in the servicing of lines from her national budget. Plenary decided that the matter should be treated in the executive session.
Senator Chia said this was not Vice President Taylor's own engagement with senators on issues pertaining to the smooth running of her office.
This is the second time, but when we contacted the Ministry of Finance, the Ministry of Finance told us that last budget year, there was serious financial constraints facing the government. As a consequence of that, several budgets were not fully implemented, including my budget.
Liberian Information Minister Eugene Nnamdi also confirmed that Vice President Taylor has also communicated her concerns with President George Weah.
Mr. President has received a letter from the Vice President, and he has already initiated efforts to resolve the issues that she has raised in this letter about her well-being. I must state, you know, that our country, we are currently undergoing an austerity measure. Mr. President himself has cut his budget, has cut his pay. Cabinet ministers receive a lot of
support. There are unconfirmed reports of a rift between Vice President Taylor and President Weah. It is not clear when the Senate will be able to address the concerns raised by Vice President Taylor. Meanwhile, the Vice President remains inactive. Moses Gazil, VOA News, Monrovia.
The Zimbabwean government has proposed a constitutional amendment that critics say is aimed at consolidating President Emmerson Mnangagwa's power. Ade Gondo has more.
The proposed amendment has a number of clauses which critics say are contentious, such as the removal of the running mate provision. The running mate clause, which is set to take effect from the 2023 general election, is poised to fall away should the gazetted bill become law. Under the current clause, the president and his deputies were meant to be jointly elected to office. This means a deputy would become an elected official, so firing him or her would be an onerous task. The late president, Robert Mugabe, fired the then vice president, Mnangagwa, at the height of the ZANU-PF succession fight. Observers say Mnangagwa appears to be seeking the same instrument that was used to expel him. Lavmo Maduku of the National Constitutional Assembly, which is part of the Political Actors Dialogue Pollard platform, says the group's members charged that they were not consulted and that the bill is an affront to the spirit of constitutionalism.
We oppose it on procedure. The constitution must not be simply amended at the instance of the ruling party or the government of the day. Procedurally, that is wrong. Regardless of what they are putting in.
Observers say the bill is a power play intended at helping Mnangagwa deal with internal resistance in the event of a succession challenge within his own party, ZANU-PF. Opposition Member of Parliament Kutsatsa Pulu, who is responsible for constitutional affairs in the main opposition party MDC, says the proposal is retrogressive.
Most of the amendments, if you look at them, they reduce accountability. These amendments are horrendous, and they wind us back to a pre-2013 position. What the government has done is that they've really said they want to rubbish the 2013 constitution, and they're moving away from democracy more and more.
Another contentious clause would allow judges of the Constitutional Court and Supreme Court to extend their tenure each year after reaching age 70 for up to 5 years.
Dr. Sadi Gondo reporting from Harare, Zimbabwe. For Daybreak Africa Sports, here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with basketball news, where Algeria became the latest team to advance to the FIBA AfroBasket 2021 qualifiers round, despite a 99-90 home defeat against Cape Verde on Thursday. And thanks to their 79-67 win on Wednesday, Algeria closed the two-game series with a 169-166 win on aggregate, and they will now join Nigeria, Mali, and Rwanda in Group D, whose action takes place next window from November the 23rd to December the 1st at venues yet to be determined. In athletics news, former world junior 800 meters champion Alfred Kipketer is the latest Kenyan athlete to be provisionally suspended by the Athletics Integrity Unit for doping violations. The 23-year-old, a finalist in the 800 meters at the 2016 Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro, allegedly failed to make himself available for out-of-competition drugs tests. Kipketer, who also won the world youth title in 2013 and reached the final of the 2015 International Association of Athletics Federations World Championships in Beijing, will not be allowed to compete again until the case is fully investigated, leaving his participation at this year's Olympic Games in Tokyo in doubt. In handball news, Tunisia is hosting the 2020 Men's Handball African Championship, also known as the African Cup of Nations, which is underway in Tunisia and will last until Sunday, the 26th of January. A total of 16 nations will play 52 games, initially in a preliminary round featuring four groups of four teams each. The overall winners of the championship will book their place directly to the Tokyo 2020 Olympic Games, while the second and third place teams qualifying through to the 2020 Olympic qualification tournaments to be held in April. Kenya is one of the participating countries, and Peter Mwati is the coach of the Kenya handball team.
The Confederation of African Body classification, the ranking, it puts Kenya in a better position, and this is because of the previous international matches that we have played, and we have been able to give our best in it.
In football news, FECAFOOT, the Cameroon Football Federation, has announced that the 2021 African Cup of Nations will be played in January and February next year, rather than the mooted June-July time slot. The 2021 AFCON was set to follow in the footsteps of the 2019 edition, which saw Egypt host in the months of June and July, thereby aligning with the European football calendar. However, concerns over weather conditions in Cameroon in the middle months of the year have forced FECAFOOT to shift the tournament forward 6 months. And in Ghana, the Ghana Football Association has appointed Charles Akono as its new national team coach to replace Kwesi Appiah. That's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that is it for this Friday, January 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Carl Bernstein, I'm James Botte in Washington, wishing all of you a very good weekend.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa,
Historically black colleges and universities in the United States are expanding in Africa. HBCUs on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Thank you.